this facility. Yeah, our first case today is case number 58727, Robert Cucinato, is that correct? Okay, versus Deloitte Touche. And for the record, Chief Justice Pickering has recused from participating in this case, so we'll go ahead and proceed with the arguments. Mr. Sterling, on behalf of the appellants, and Mr. Davido is on behalf of the respondents. Go ahead.
Just a quick introduction. My name is Neil Zirkel with the firm of Cooper Levinson. Cooper Levinson is local counsel in this case. Next to me is Scott Sterling. He's been admitted as pro hac vice and he's been doing the presentation today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterling.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Again, my name is Scott Sterling, the counsel for the plaintiffs and the appellants in this case, Robert Cucinato and Kareem Mascatilla. Your Honor, this case should not have been decided summarily. And there is no compelling reason or argument on the facts or with respect to the law involved in this case to cause the court to change the law from, with respect to privilege, from an absolute, from a qualified privilege to an absolute privilege, nor to make any change in the law to change from the requirement of actual malice to overcome a privilege to requiring malice in fact. I have in mind there were questions the court indicated that it would like to have answered, specifically in the context of the argument of this case. And let me start with the second question, whether there was sufficient evidence of malice. The standard, it is clear under existing law, is that it requires proof of actual malice to overcome a privilege, a conditional privilege, which is the most that could be said to exist in this case. In order to prove malice...
Counsel, I'm going to have to interrupt and ask you to speak up. The acoustics in this room are lousy at best.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to do better. In order to overcome a qualified privilege with evidence of actual malice, all that is required is to show that there is, quote, obvious reasons to doubt the veracity of the informant or the accuracy of his report. That's from the Hart-Hanks case, 401 U.S. at 688. That is the law that establishes the constitutional, what is called constitutional malice or actual malice, and that is the standard that has been followed through in the states as well that adhere to that, that same standard of actual malice. At the center of the claims made in the bulletin in this case, that GCA was purportedly committing fraud, defrauding the gaming industry, was the claim that GCA was manipulating codes in order to defraud customers. By manipulating the code in the software, that it was producing results so that customers were being charged more than they were entitled or deserved to be charged under their contracts. That fact, as we've pointed out in our opening brief and in our reply brief, was the subject of an analysis, and it was completely dissected by Deloitte and Touche in the years between 1999 and 2001, 2002, when this fraud is alleged to have occurred, according to the bulletin. Those were the years when these events were occurring. It implied that it was continuing. But in fact, Deloitte had become aware that there was a coding issue. That issue was thoroughly dissected. It was disclosed in the initial public offering memorandum in 2005. It was a result of follow-on work by Deloitte in its audit testing, where it was required by GAS in order to conduct tests to detect evidence of fraud. And it was determined that there was no fraud. There had been errors in coding. They were corrected, but there was no fraud. So,
Counselor,
Deloitte,
you've limited your response as that single issue. On the flyer, there was an issue. Well, weren't there other things that were mentioned in this memorandum that they became aware of?
Yes, the bulletin that Deloitte received from MGM included that claim as well as some others. But the question that I think is...
And aren't they obligated to look at the reliability or potential liability of the source of that comment as well?
They're required to do exactly what the statute says, which is to determine whether it is likely that an illegal act has actually occurred and to see that the board
after going through additional steps, if so, if they determine that it is likely that illegal acts have actually occurred, then they are required to take further steps, which may include going to the board of directors and asking the board of directors to take further action, including remedial action. If the board refuses, they are required then to go to the SEC and to take further steps in furtherance of that. Only if those, if they determine that it is likely that illegal acts have occurred and that the board then has refused to take appropriate steps in response to that. Here, they had obvious reasons to doubt the veracity of the informant or the accuracy of the reports because they knew, Deloitte knew, that what was claimed about the manipulating codes to defraud its customers was false. They had looked at it before. They had resolved it. They had found that there was no evidence of fraud. They were required to test for fraud, and they had, as recently as their 2006 audit, and they knew that they knew what that story was. They knew it wasn't true.
Did the work papers of Deloitte for the prior years discuss or investigate the transfer of funds to the Middle East?
No.
Alleged acts of murder or some other criminal behavior on the part of GCA or its principals?
No, they had not.
We'd appreciate if you could address the public policy question about whether this court should consider the restatement absolute privilege rule, which we haven't heretofore done. Well, I think the facts under this case would suggest that this is one where we should look at it at least. I'm not sure accounting firms who have duties to shareholders and board of directors under the SEC for publicly traded companies are in the best position to be reporting to those folks serious acts of criminal behavior. They usually check out financial information.
Correct. And in fact, Your Honor, the other conduct that was alleged there had no bearing upon the accuracy of the financial statements or Deloitte's role in auditing them. If it were true, which it is not, that the FBI was actually conducting an active investigation into those matters, should have been left to the FBI to pursue those other matters and to see whether there was any likelihood that there actually was an illegal act occurring. There was no evidence of any illegal act occurring that related to the financial statements because all of those acts had been the subject of prior analysis and had been and Deloitte had that knowledge.
I thought you just said the illegal transfer of funds to the Middle East wasn't an issue that was previously discussed.
It was not.
Okay.
Yes, but that fact had no bearing. In fact, has no bearing on the accuracy of their financial statements. What was described there did not have bearing upon the accuracy of the GCA's financial statements, except if it were true that GCA itself was sending money overseas, so that money that should have appeared on GCA's financial statements was in fact being diverted to finance terrorism or for whatever other
purpose. Well, the allegation doesn't affect the integrity of the whole financial aspect.
In that circumstance, it could.
Yes.
And with respect to that specific point, Deloitte's Larry Krauss, the engagement partner, testified that he knew of no way that that was possible. He had reason to doubt. All of Deloitte knew that that was not true or could not be true because they audited their financial statements. If $10 million was missing, it would have shown up in their financial statements and their audits. He knew that that was not true. They had reason to doubt that as well. And they published that, notwithstanding knowing that that was described as Miles Kilburn on the board of directors as a fantastical claim. And Larry Krauss admitted that he knew of no way it was possible that that could have occurred. So when they repeated that claim, and they actually abbreviated it, they deleted material information that was in the bulletin, and they gave their script to the audit board, the result was that they omitted information which would have permitted them to immediately identify what was actually being described there and to point out that, in fact, there was no financing of terrorism. There was a legitimate financing, of a charity by Mr. Mascatia. It was right out in the open. The amounts were disclosed. Transfers were all publicly known.
So you're saying that Deloitte, based on that analysis, wouldn't even tell the board of directors of the company of the FBI bulletin?
No, not without first doing what Section 10A actually requires, which is to determine whether it is likely that an illegal act has actually occurred. What they have done here, and what is described in the cases, is a deliberate avoidance of the facts. They had Larry Krause, who was brand new to this case, up into this audit client in October of 2007. He brought in other people who had no prior experience with these audits, counsel from New York, people who were members of internal committees at Deloitte, and they discussed what to do, but they deliberately excluded the former engagement partner from their discussions, who had actually lived through the prior audits and knew what they had done and knew what they had discovered and knew what the facts were. They deliberately excluded members of the audit team, current and past members, so that they made no effort to find out what Deloitte itself already knew in order to decide whether it was likely that an illegal act had occurred. That is unavailing because notwithstanding Mr. Krause's personal ignorance of that history, notwithstanding the fact that others brought him to talk to him did not know that history, Deloitte knew it. Deloitte, the entity, the defendant in this case, knew everything that the former engagement partner knew everything that the members of the audit team knew, and knew everything that their audit work papers showed.
Well, in this economic environment, is it unreasonable for the management of Deloitte to, upon receiving this information, have concerns that maybe the audit partner was involved too?
Not with
and segregate him from further reporting and investigation.
I don't think it is all reasonable to simply to assume that your own audit engagement partners are corrupted. An audit organization like Deloitte cannot make that kind of assumption without actually doing the work of inquiring, of asking, of reviewing the work papers. If they thought a member of the work team had been corrupted, there are others. Even if they thought all of them were corrupted, there are work papers. They had access to that information. They knew the information and they ignored it when they made their defamatory report to the audit committee. With respect to the...
In your view, the reporting of this with the information that they had about coding was malicious.
Yes, it satisfies the requirement of actual malice. They had obvious reasons to doubt the accuracy of the informant or its reports, not only with respect to the coding issue, but also with respect to the alleged transfer of money worldwide without being detected. They knew that both of those points were nonsense. One of them was actually false because they didn't...
And so the remaining allegations in the bulletin, they should just ignore?
No, they should not just ignore them. They're required to do what the statute says, which is to attempt to determine whether it is likely that an illegal act has occurred. And that permits them to inquire of management. It does not require them to republish defamatory statements in the form in which they did it, the manner they did it here. They have the option of inquiring with management to get additional information about all of the issues that were described in that bulletin. If, for example, if they had made a call to the Fremont, Michigan Police Department to inquire about the murder of Mr. Muscatilla's wife, they would have been told no such murder ever occurred in Fremont, Michigan. In fact, they live in California. That happened more than 20 years ago. He was never a suspect in that case. But if they had done any kind of inquiry on those other points, including with publicly available sources, they would have been told there was nothing to support them. Let me just say, with respect to the earlier question about adopting the absolute privilege of the restatement, I think that is unwise for several reasons. One, you've already decided as recently as 1999 in Bank of America versus Bordeaux that there should be a qualified privilege where there's a duty to report. And in 2005, Pope versus Motel 6, he said that it was appropriate to balance the interests of those who would be defamed against other interests served by a qualified privilege. If the court says, in every case where there is any duty to report, which takes in a wide range of potential circumstances, there is an absolute immunity automatically, you are taking away from the legislature the ability to create a duty to report without an absolute immunity, and a duty to report with absolute immunity where they think that's appropriate, and which they have done in a number of other circumstances. I don't think the court should lay down a blanket rule that takes that flexibility away from the legislature. If I can, excuse me, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Sir Mark. Okay, Mr. Davido, on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Charles Davido on behalf of the respondents. This is the perfect case for an absolute privilege. although Mr. Sterling has not mentioned it, the government promulgated rules that dictate how accounting firms must respond during their audits to evidence of possible wrongdoing is contained in AU 317.10, which we cite in our brief and include in the appendix. It was promulgated by the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was created in 2002 by Congress under Sarbanes-Oxley, and its written standards are governing law. It says, and I quote, "When the auditor becomes aware of information concerning a possible illegal act, the auditor should obtain an understanding of the nature of the act, the circumstances in which it occurred, and sufficient other information to evaluate the effect on the financial statements. In doing so, the auditor should inquire of management at a level above those involved, if possible." It could not be clearer. Deloitte's obligation on coming into this information was to go to management, the audit committee in this case, which is its client, which are the people who engaged it for the purpose of protecting public investors so that a proper investigation can be done. This FBI bulletin was not simply water cooler conversation. It was an official document which Deloitte confirmed the authenticity of before it took any steps outside of its own four walls.
What about the argument counsel made about the coding issue? You already investigated that. You found it to be without merit years prior. Wouldn't that pique your interest that perhaps this document was some rogue, unreliable document?
Quite the contrary, Your Honor. The issue had come up several years ago because there had been coding violations. Steps had been taken to prevent those coding violations. Now you have an FBI document saying it's happening again. It's happening in the present. The FBI document used the present tense to describe this. The fact that it had occurred in the past, and you thought you had fixed it, but now the FBI is suggesting it may be occurring again, is no reason to take it seriously, not less. And I would add, when the investigation was done in response to Deloitte's request, it found that there were coding issues. It did not find that they were intentional, but it found that there were $2.9 million of continuing coding issues. So I would say, Your Honor, that that made it more, not less likely that this was to be considered. And with respect to the transfer in support of terrorism issue with which Mr. Sterling raised, he says on the one hand, no transfers. Transfers couldn't have been detected. But then he points out that there had been a very substantial contribution by Mr. Mesketeer to a Pakistani charity. Well, that may be terrific. On the other hand, if you're Deloitte and you receive information about a transfer abroad, and the FBI suggesting that it's in support of terrorism, you would want to check that out. Because contrary to Mr. Sterling's suggestion that it's unrelated to the financial statements, Your Honors are more familiar than I am with the Gaming Control Board and how it would respond to a situation in which the two controlling shareholders and members of the board of directors are engaged in the kinds of activities that were alleged in the FBI bulletin. This would, if true, have put into doubt the continuing viability of the company, which is a key underpinning of any financial statement.
Which is why you would argue the murder allegation was relevant as well.
Indeed, I would, Your Honor. Any of these relating to such serious conduct by controlling shareholders requires attention. Well, the Lord did not hire an airplane to skywrite this. It didn't go to the Wall Street Journal with it. It considered it carefully determined what its obligations were. It requested a call with the audit committee, which is the narrowest and the appropriate committee. It laid out as best it could, consistent with the Justice Department's instructions, what the allegations were here. It requested an investigation to determine the veracity of these allegations. And when the investigation was completed and found that there was not a basis for them, it accepted those allegations and went on with its audit. This is exactly the conduct that public investors and this court should want an accounting firm to do under circumstances like this.
Counsel, you also indicated that you had an obligation or duty to go to the board of GCA and query them. Do you see a duty or obligation to do that at all in any of the regs?
Well, I think The obligation is to go to the audit committee and request that they perform an investigation. That investigation should be done and was done here by outside counsel responding to members of the board whose integrity and whose actions were not at issue. That, I believe, is what the obligation was, Your Honor.
And does the fact that the FBI had actually informed you there was no active investigation ongoing, does that cause you concern at all in this?
Well, Your Honor, it didn't quite inform us that there was no active investigation.
Okay.
Mr. Sterling is referring, I believe, there are two things he may be referring to. One is to a letter he got a year and a half later, after these events, saying the FBI, at that time, he had no information. At the time of the events in question, what we had was this FBI bulletin, which was less than 1 month old. The people at Deloitte made a number of calls to try and determine whether this was accurate. A person at one of the FBI's offices who answered the phone said she didn't see that listed. But there were multiple offices of the FBI that were involved, and the conclusion that Deloitte reached, indeed the conclusion it had to reach, was it could not say, no, this is the sort of treatment we would give something if someone told us that the CEO was actually an alien from the planet Venus. This was not that kind of case. This was one where there were serious allegations, and the company had tried to check them out and instead been told, this is confidential, you can't spread it. That kind of response wouldn't diminish one's concerns, it would enhance it. You've been told, in essence, we don't want you to put this into the hands of the people who are involved. If so, Your Honor,
yes.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
In part, we were careful to point out, as counsel argued, that the conditional privilege should address these circumstances because of the importance of weighing the injury to the allegedly defamed individual versus the duties of disclosure. How is this case different than Pope? What is it about this case that drives consideration to adopting this provision of the restatement rather than leaving it to the legislature to evaluate, and perhaps in that process, if you were persuasive, limiting the absolute privilege to accountants?
Well, Your Honor, first, what's different about this case from Pope is that in Pope the issue was, can people talk to the police about matters that we were aware in that case, but there was a thought that a theft had occurred. Here you have an actual law that requires the company to go to the auditors to go to the board. This is a case where the legislature has spoken, in this case the Congress, and it has said it is so important to us that we are affirmatively putting an obligation on you to publish this information, at least within the limited scope of going to the audit committee, which is as far as we went. To me, Your Honor, that's quite compelling.
So that burden would become a distinguishing factor in cases in which the absolute privilege is claimed under the restatement?
I believe so, Your Honor. It seems to me there would be a couple of limiting factors. One is the statement needs to be made to the party to whom you're obligated to make it. Had we taken out an ad in the Wall Street Journal, that would be a somewhat different story. And second, the statements you need must relate to the issue on which you're required to make disclosure. Just as this court in the Circus against Witherspoon case said that there is a relevance test, that, it seems to me, is the appropriate test here. It gives a little elbow room so you don't have a complaint every time quibbling with the precise wording of what was said. But so long as it's as the legislature is obligated to be firm to say this, and the statement is made to the appropriate audience and contains the appropriate subject, it seems to me this completely captures the purpose of the restatement rule. Indeed, it also contains an element of fairness, because it simply isn't fair to tell parties you must make these disclosures and at the same time say that we're going to expose you to the cost of discovery, litigation, and a jury trial when you do what we've required of you. Indeed, when this court has addressed the absolute privilege in the context of judicial statements, it is focused on the fact that in certain situations, the public interest in having people speak freely outweighs the risk that individuals will occasionally abuse the privilege by making false and malicious statements. This is the perfect such instance, I would respectfully submit. I would like to say a word on the third question the court had asked, which is whether a party can be at fault for tortious interference for conduct that's privileged for purposes of defamation. This is an issue that we addressed in our brief, but relatively briefly given the page constraints here. The policy considerations are exactly the same. Indeed, since most actions that are alleged to be tortious interference occur through statements, oral or written, not to recognize the same privileges would make it very easy for any plaintiff to circumvent the public policies and the rules governing defamation. Indeed, the Judge Reed of the U.S. District Court here in Nevada wrote that there's every reason to predict the Nevada Supreme Court would apply state law privileges designed to protect speech in the context of tortious interference with a contract, just as it has defamation. That was the Quickstar case at 566 F sub 2nd, 1205-1214. Virtually all state courts that have addressed this have reached that conclusion. And to quote the Ohio Supreme Court on that point, to permit imposition of liability on the basis of something less than actual malice, merely because the same publication is alleged to be actionable on some other legal theory, would drastically frustrate the objective of promoting human input on public concerns. Plaintiffs in their brief argue that their malicious interference claim doesn't relate to the defamation. If they now say, that's different, that relates to what you did after Mr. Mascottia threatened litigation against you. But if you look at paragraph 88 of their complaint, quite to the contrary, it says, the tortious interference took the form of defamation and other actions. The only thing they specify is the defamation. That's what this case is about, and they shouldn't be permitted to amend their complaint at this point. Even if they were allowed to, though, once again, we put in expert testimony from the former acting chief accountant of the SEC saying that once Deloitte received the threat of litigation, it properly concluded that its independence was threatened. The issue there is that investors are entitled to the work of an auditor that is fully independent and objective. When a company, not a client, threatens litigation against the auditor, its self-interest comes into play. Mr. Mascottia threatened litigation because he was considering the very suit that he has subsequently brought and wanted to get information about this FBI bulletin. Deloitte, upon receiving that threat, concluded, as the accounting rules suggest, that their independence was at issue, and there were three ways it could be resolved. They could step away from the audit, which is one solution. Mr. Mascottia could withdraw the threat of litigation, or Mr. Mascottia could leave the board so that Deloitte would no longer be adverse to the company or its senior members. The company made the choice which way it wanted to go. Once again, Deloitte acted as the rules called for. Under tortious interference, an element, plaintiff's element, is to show that the conduct was unprivileged. Here, the accounting rules indicated that the board did what it was obligated to do, and the unrebutted expert testimony supported that. Unless the court has further questions, I thank you for your attention.
Any other questions from justices?
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to make just a few points quickly if I can. First, the interpretation of a statute is for the court. It's a matter of law and it is not a subject of expert opinion testimony. Section 10A did not require the auditors to do what they did in this case. It provides that they may inquire of management. They should inquire of management where necessary as part of their determination whether it is likely that an illegal act has occurred. But nothing in Section 10A required Deloitte to do what they did in this case, which is to publish defamatory statements, claim that they were vouched for their credibility, which no basis for doing.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
They vouched for the credibility of the source.
Simply by publishing is what you're...
No, they actually said, we have determined that the source is credible. They had no idea who the actual source of any of the unsourced statements in that bulletin was. They had no idea where that information was coming from, and they deliberately made no effort to find out.
It's telling that Section 10A does create absolute immunity for reports to the SEC, but the Congress made a deliberate decision not to create absolute immunity for reports to a board of directors. So this court should not say, as it were, accept the argument that it is necessary to do that, to create absolute liability in order to fulfill the congressional intent here. We have answered the interference and independence issue in our reply brief. I believe it is more correct to say that the gaming board, if these allegations about the individuals were found to be true, what it would require is that those individuals sell their shares and separate themselves from the company. It would not terminate the company's existence.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Thank the attorneys for their excellent arguments and briefs. This matter will stand submitted.